Hello and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, to listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 FM up there in Preston, and Q Radio in Hertfordshire, and to our listeners in Swindon, hello Swindon FM. You can also access the show on the internet at radioforall.net, that's number4-all.net.
I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm Kay Sanger-Daffy.
And I'm James Melia.
Coming up in the show.
Public access darkrooms are opening up again to meet this demand from people who are rediscovering classic wet photography.
Back to the darkroom, traditional photography makes a comeback.
Because he always said he was not an impressionist, although they were very close. Moni and he used to go and paint in the river and on boats, and that was a very great interest of theirs.
Manet comes out of the shadows at the RWA. Okay, now joined in the studio by Darren Jones and Colin McNamee. Darren, you're here from the Labour Party, Colin from the UKIP Party. We really wanted to sort of have a chat today about the EU and obviously David Cameron making an announcement recently about the referendum of whether Britain should stay in or leave the European Union. What's your thoughts on the subject, Darren? Where do you think the UK should be? What are the benefits for the UK being in the EU?
Well, I think what's clear is that what we saw a few weeks ago was David Cameron playing party politics, not leading the country. And I'm sure Colin would agree with me that the reason that we had this speech and the reason that he's pledged to have a referendum after the next election was merely to keep his backbench Tory MPs happy, not to act in the best interests of the country. I think it's dangerous. I think it's a gamble on the future of economic growth and the role of Britain in the world. And I was disappointed that he took the steps to do so. It shows that he was a party leader and not a good leader for our country.
Well, before David Cameron actually made his speech, I went into a Buc-ee's for the first time in 50 years, and I placed a bet that David Cameron would not be leader of the Conservative Party at the end of the year. I stand to win a couple of cases of champagne with the money. The Labour Party are in a very confused position because of coming out of David Cameron's speech in the following Wednesday at Prime Minister's Question Time, David Miliband outrightly refused to include a referendum on the EU. Outright refusal. Bit confusing because in 1997, 2001 and 2005, the Labour Party had in their manifesto, and because they were subsequently elected, were in a position to implement it, a referendum on the EU. They failed to do so. They're not really representing the working class in this country anymore. Those times are long since gone.
Well, I don't think I'm confused. And I don't think the party is confused. I think Ed Miliband has been quite clear on the position. And just because there was a manifesto commitment in previous elections doesn't mean that our policy or our position can't change with time. And I think what Ed has been very clear on is that actually David Cameron's approach of talking about having a referendum in so many years' time, even having that conversation creates instability in our country at a time when we need stability, when we need to be able to generate economic growth and opportunities for business and for workers in our country. And indeed, as a European Union, we are the largest political bloc in the world, the largest trading business entity in the world. We need to be able to harbour that opportunity for the people of this country. And that links to your wrong comments about the Labour Party not standing up for working class people. Only last week or the week before, perhaps, Ed was talking about reinstating the 10 pence tax credit, the 10 pence tax rate, and paying for that through the introduction of the mansion tax. That shows that we understand the issues of hardworking families in our country, of ordinary people.
I suggest he only did that because it was Gordon Brown who abolished it in the first place.
And Ed agreed that Gordon made the mistake in doing that.
Well, that's all right then. So you can continue to apologise over that, just like now Yvette Cooperman and Alan Johnson and the others are apologising that whilst you were in power, you made the mistake as far as immigration was concerned, and you're now all holding your hands up and saying, yeah, well, we got that wrong. Gosh, that's tough. I can only think back to Gordon Brown in the north of England when he called that elderly lady a bigot because she was expressing concern about the numbers of immigration, which now, strangely enough, all three main parties are expressing concern about the numbers, not the race, not the colour, the numbers. And it's exactly what UKIP was saying in 2005 and what we're saying very clearly now. It's the numbers, and it's the EU, not the UK Westminster government, who are governing.
I don't think there's anything wrong with politicians recognising that they could have done things differently, or indeed that they plan to do things differently in the future. And what's quite interesting is that all of your comments, Colin, much like the rest of your party, are harking back to a time in British history and not providing a vision for a future. And we've said that actually, you know, with the introduction of the new member states within the European Union, that we agree with phasing the controls on the numbers of immigrants coming into to the UK, and that a mistake was made in us not adopting that approach before. I think the people of this country would actually respect politicians in saying, look, we tried a particular method and that instance didn't work. We've learnt the lessons and we're moving on, as opposed to politicians actually saying, you know, actually we're right all the way through.
That's not a reasonable comparison. The damage has been done. The damage has been done not only to the benefit system, not only to housing, not only to jobs. You can't just hold your hand up, say I'm sorry, walk away and call it history. It's a legacy that will follow this country and the Labour Party for decades to come.
And I'd be interested then, Colin, to understand what UKIP's position is on wider issues and generating economic growth, which will lead to more housing. It will lead to a reduction in the number of people on benefits because of employment. It would lead to a stronger economy because of our contribution in reforming and leading on a European Union level and not pulling out and endangering economic growth and opportunities for the people of this country. Once again, you're talking about the past and not providing a solution for the future.
Not at all. It's interesting that you're now beginning to sound like a Conservative, because the Conservative position for 40 years is, and still is, we must belong to the EU and we'll change it from within. We have approximately 8% representation in the Brussels Parliament. 8%. You ain't going to change it, and it is broke.
Well, you know, I disagree with that position. I think the European Union has a huge amount of potential in the way that the future of our world is governed on some really quite significant issues such as the environment and climate change, which, let's be honest, if we don't get that right, we'll have the biggest contribution to economic downfall and the living standards of people in our world today. And I think that Britain has a lot to contribute to ensuring that Europe is fit for purpose in the future. And I would rather be involved in it and reforming it from the inside than be on the outskirts of it as a small country, a tiny country in comparison to the emerging markets in this country, and not be able to influence global politics in a way that generates a world that we want to live in, but also the right opportunities for the people of this country.
There are 51 countries that have a trading-only arrangement with the EU. Trading, not political. When this country's electorate was asked about staying in, not going in, but staying in the EEC, the European Economic Community, in 1977, it was a trade-only arrangement, not political. The UK is the largest receiver of goods from the Eurozone in the world. They ain't going to put that or jeopardise that position. The Eurozone exports more to the UK, €213 billion, 2011, as opposed to the USA, €200,000 billion, as opposed to China, €195 billion. The UK accounts for 12% of the Eurozone sales.
Well, I'm pleased to see, Colin, that you're beginning to recognise the importance of the global environment in which we operate. And as you've been referring to those great nations around the world, the United States actually disagrees with you and has been quite clear that it would rather have Britain as a player reforming the future of the European Union. And indeed, after the President Obama's State of the Nation, as we know, the United States wants to form a trading agreement with the European Union because it recognises that the vision of the European Union for the future of this world is one in which it's going to be important to play a role in. And you've mentioned China. You know, the population of China being that double, I think it is, than the size of the UK and the USA put together. If Britain is going to continue to play a role internationally, it can only do so by being a part of the European Union. And I'm pleased you're recognising that we need to do that.
Of course Obama wants the UK in the EU, because the Americans do not understand Europe. They'd rather deal with one voice, regardless of who that one person is representing. They do not understand selling or exporting to Europe. I've been there, I've done it, and I've dealt with the Americans. Unfortunately, Prime Minister Blair opened a door in his relationship with initially Bush and the way that he took us into other things because of American influence. We are not as small as you would think we are.
Well, I think we are. I mean, you have to look at the numbers, Colin. It's quite clear. And the reason is, it's because population size is increasingly playing a crucial role in relation to the ability for countries to play economic and political roles of importance in our world, largely because of the increasing flexibility of capital to move around populations, and which is why it correlates to population size. And Britain by itself is a tiny, tiny nation in comparison to the emerging markets of this world. I agree, and I'm going to go on the historical route that you keep going with, that Britain has a great thing to offer to this world in terms of our values of democracy, of free speech, of welcoming people of the world into a place of tolerance and understanding.
I can understand why you're not comfortable with historic references, because the Labour Party track record historically is simply not good. There has never been ever a Labour Party that came into office and left the economy of this country in a better state than when they found it. Okay, that's a statement of fact. Now, at the end of Gordon Brown's administration, yes, the bankers certainly affected the adverse effects of the economy spinning out of America. But prior to that, the country was in an economic mess, thanks to Labour.
I like your simple facts, and I'm glad you agree that the last recession, that we're about to enter into a triple dip because of this Tories' failed economic policy at the moment, was due to the financial crash, not to Gordon Brown. And you will have seen, for example, that in the months before the May 2010 general election, under Alistair Darling's plan, this economy was growing in our country. It was going to be creating prosperity for the future of this country after the financial crash. And since the Tories have come in, all of that's been...
For the first 12 months of the coalition, they actually stayed with Darling's plan. It was Darling's plan. After that, he was borrowing even more. The objective of UKIP is to take back control and sovereignty of the country so that we are governed from Westminster. We're ruled by Brussels. Governed from Westminster, having a parliament that the British electorate can decide to get rid of after 4 or 5 years, whatever that term is agreed. You cannot get rid of the bureaucracy in Brussels. It cannot be done. We cannot change it from within. We can set up our own border controls. We can export to any country in the world, which we cannot under EU legislation. We cannot. It is not our choice. It is not a sovereign choice.
It's lovely that you hark back again to this idea of British rule and British sovereignty. I agree, it makes you the cockles warm. And I'm sure many people would agree. Everyone loves the idea of a great nation.
I think that Westminster and the Queen's cockles were obviously warmed. The new Commonwealth Royal Charter was signed. So there's a Commonwealth which is much more effective and much larger than the inhibiting states of the very small EU trading bloc. I think you need to appreciate there is a much bigger world out there.
Oh, I fully appreciate and love the Commonwealth. I think they're great. Britain outside of the European Union is a dangerous idea in the way that we play a role in the world in the future years to come.
In what way?
In many ways. I'll give you three. The first one we've talked about is economic growth. If the trade agreement between the United States and Europe is one that works well, we won't be involved in that in the way that we could be by being at the centre of Europe. Number two, the reason that we can help reform Europe from the inside means that we can make Europe better, and through Europe have an international influence that is one that we are playing a part in. And three, and one that I think is very important, and one that actually all of us politicians don't talk about very often, is the role that blocs have on important issues like environmental regulation and tackling climate change. Because, as I said earlier, if we don't get these types of issues right, the effects of climate change will have the biggest impact, the biggest negative impact on our economy and our way of life that we've ever known.
Taking your second point, we've already established the UK, no one country can change the EU makeup on its own. Can't be done. Last week, Osborne found out on a vote of 26-1 he couldn't change the position regarding bankers' bonuses. Can't do it. The Conservatives have been trying to change the EU from within for about 43 years. As far as trade is concerned, our exports, accepting that it's a home market, but for the generic, exports is about 35% of our total export sales go to the EU. 35%, not the 50, not the 60, which is now being talked about. Going back right to the first question at the start of this programme about Cameron's EU referendum. Well, that's seriously jammed tomorrow. But one very interesting thing he did say, that as the debate got underway, let us have reasonable statistics and facts presented. Now, you obviously don't like facts, but he did say that within the debate, let's have facts. Do you know, within a week, the government and Nick Clegg was talking about 60% of our exports. 60% of our exports go to the EU. Not true. Not true.
Thanks there to Colin McNamee and Darren Jones.
Yes, over to our second guest, who's here to talk about photography. We're now joined by Chris Waller from Bristol City Council's Adult Education Scheme. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
I believe your particular specialism in the Adult Education Scheme Council run is photography.
It is indeed, yes. Now, I teach what I call real photography, that is wet photography, which involves sloshing around in darkened rooms with tubs of chemicals.
So that's obviously as opposed to digital photography, which most people would be probably more familiar with now, I think it's fair to say. Why is sort of film photography of particular interest to yourself?
Well, I suppose, one, it's a generational issue. I mean, I grew up with black and white photography. I can go back that far. But what I like about it most is the sense of involvement in photography. Using film, you know, you choose your film, you choose your developer, you process it yourself, and you can control very finely the results that you get. And for me, there's a certain degree of abstraction in the use of black and white photography. One thinks of classic black and white images. I just love the whole tactile experience of using film and printing on paper, and the experience of being in the dark room under red light. It's a wholly different world. And since these days we seem to spend most of our lives sitting in front of computer terminals, it's nice to get away from that and go into this special space where you're cut off from the outside world. And it's quiet and the light's dim and you're doing this sort of magic process at the end of which up comes your print in the tray. You know, and it's still, even now, 30 years after I first did it, I still get a terrific thrill seeing that final print coming up there.
And you're finding a lot of your students coming in and either discovering or already sharing your passion for film photography.
What's interesting now is that a lot of my students, of course, have actually grown up with digital photography. And then they discover this process. It's probably a lot of them say, oh, well, my uncle used to do this, my father used to do this, and I've just picked up, found his old camera. I'd like to know how to use it. And they put a roll of film through it and they process it. And even, you know, quite sophisticated late 20-something people, they pull the reel of film out of the tank having processed, and they see these negatives and they're absolutely amazed at this strange arcane process whereby you pour chemicals into a tank and agitate it, produces a strip of negs, and they're really amazed by it. It's so completely different to digital photography. You're almost getting back more or less to the sort of skills of the painter, because it is very tactile.
So would you say that it's film photography is something that's growing in popularity a bit more now?
It is, indeed. Probably going back perhaps 12 to 18 months ago, we were one of the last two public access darkrooms in the country. But in that period, around the country, in Birmingham, Cambridge, Aberdeen, Edinburgh, Birmingham, public access darkrooms are opening up again to meet this demand from people who are rediscovering classic wet photography. Let me go back to my early days. My first serious photograph was taken when I was 12 years old, and I had this quaint little grey plastic Ilford Sprite camera which took a roll of 127 film, which can't get it any longer. Well, you can get it under special order. This quaint little camera, and what was happening was, this was going back into the 1960s when Dr. Beeching was ripping up the railways, and he was ripping up our local railway line, which is something that I'd known as a kid from, you know, my earliest beginnings. And so I thought, right, I'm going to take some photographs of this. And with this quaint little camera, I took my first four serious photographs of our local railway line being torn up. And at that point, I discovered the documentary power of photography, this little machine that could actually record for all time a particular view, a particular building, something like that. Once I'd taken the photograph, I'd got it preserved for all time.
How important do you think it is that actually film is a permanent record that digital perhaps isn't?
The great beauty of the analogue image is it's very easy to recover it. All you need is a lamp, a negative and a lens, and you can recover the image. Now, if you remember, going back to just before the millennium, there was a big project to put images onto 12-inch video discs. Problem is that now you can't get a machine to play the 12-inch video disc, but we can still print from negatives that were made 150 years ago because the technology is pretty much the same. It's simple technology, and therefore it's very easily accessible. If you want to, of course, you can scan negatives, but if you haven't got a scanner, you can still print from an old-fashioned negative onto photographic paper.
So going back to your tuition with Bristol Council, how many students do you regularly teach?
Well, we can teach a group of up to 10 students. We have 10 enlargers, and we can accommodate up to 10 students. Normally, I prefer sort of perhaps 7 or 8 students, because that way we've got a little bit more time and space. But, you know, nice if we've got 10. It gives us a nice group sort of atmosphere, get discussions going about photography. So it does help.
And do you find students that come in have very different sort of tastes in photography, some more interesting landscapes, some more interesting portraits, to choose two very broad fields of study?
Yes, some people do come in with saying, well, I want to shoot portraits or I want to shoot landscape. Other students, they're very open to it. And I think the important thing when you learn photography is that you don't only learn the techniques of photography, but the crucial thing is that students find their subject, find the thing that is going to motivate them to go out and take photographs. And really, in some respects, that is the more important aspect of photography. It's finding that thing that's going to drive your photography, because that is what drives you to learn more about technique, because you're trying to achieve an image and you need to learn the techniques to be able to produce that image. So that's the real driver.
So you really teach aspects like composition as well as the actual physical developing of the photo?
Oh, yes. What we do is we look through the work of famous photographers, the big-name photographers, so people can see what sort of subject matter has been approached. I mean, there's a huge range of photography, from the very academic photography by people such as Ansel Adams, through to some really quite strange photography by people such as William Eggleston and Joel Peter Witkin, for instance, who does some really strange but fascinating photography.
And I suppose that range is indicative, really, of photography as an art form.
It is indeed. Photography is a broad church. There are so many different genres within photography, so many different practitioners. They all have their own technique. They all have their own chosen subject matter. And as you become more experienced in photography, you can look at a picture and you think, oh, yeah, that's, you know, by somebody like Clarence John Loughlin, because you know his subject matter, you know his approach to photography. Yeah, it's a huge scope for looking at photography.
So if any of our listeners have had their interest piqued by your discussions today and you're interested in finding out and maybe coming on one of your photography courses themselves, is there any way they can get in contact with you or any websites that you can point them towards?
Well, we have the Bristol City Council Adult Learning website, and if you're interested in becoming a member of the Dark Rooms, we do have a website. It's www.stpaulsdarkrooms.wordpress.com, and the St Paul's Dark Room is STPAULS Darkrooms, all one string, .wordpress.com.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks to Chris Waller there.
Our award-winning gardener is back with more tips, so over now to Jodie Farish.
Jodie, welcome to the show again. So is there any kind of, you know, friendly wildlife or anything like that that you can try to, you know, get rid of these pests in a natural fashion?
There's a lot of wildlife out there that gardeners should try and encourage into their garden that would do a lot of the work for you and save you having to go out and buy pesticides or do the hard work yourself. And I just mentioned briefly the ladybirds that will eat aphids, but by encouraging things like the thrushes and blackbirds, they'll start targeting your slugs and your snails, which, you know, is the main pain for most people actually in a garden. Robins, blue tits and grey tits will eat many of the insects and grubs and aphids that we've already mentioned. So again, that's taken out a lot of work for you. And one of the main things that you can have in your garden that's wildlife and that's very friendly for any garden and should be essential are the earthworms. You really want to create a nice environment for earthworms because they break down the nutrients and create a very nice, a good quality, soft topsoil. Put air into the soil as well, which the plant roots are looking for, as well as water. So by all means, keep your worms in there. Don't go chopping them in half. You don't make two worms at all. Woodlice, again, when they're moving things about, they find a lot of woodlice in there. They're not particularly damaging any of your garden, but what they do help is coming out at night. They'll start breaking down things like leaf litter and things like that, which, again, creates a really good leaf mould for putting out onto your garden. One of the basic rules you can consider when you're looking at pests in your garden or small insects is if it moves fast, it's generally a good thing because it's a predator. And if it moves slowly, then generally that's not something that you want because it's a grazer. So it will be eating away at your leaves, your flowers and everything else that you're trying to grow. Other friendly wildlife might be things like frogs and toads and newts, which will eat very young, the smaller slugs and snails. Again, with hoverflies and butterflies and bees, they're all pollinators, so it's great to see them, and they will keep your flowers growing and create the pollinating for next year. And some bees also sting grubs, and wasps also do this. They'll sting the grubs to act as a host for their young to grow. So when people say, what good are wasps, they are actually helping in some gardens just by keeping down the grub infestations.
Yeah, so is there any other pests a bit larger that you need to be looking out for as well? You've talked about aphids quite a bit, but is there anything else that's maybe a little bit more obvious?
As many gardeners know, there's always something out there that's trying to attack your fruit and vegetables. So a lot of my customers have problems with rabbits. They can jump over quite high fences, they get through very small gaps, and they can also tunnel underneath get fencing and the hedgerows. So one of the best ways to deal with those is to put a decent fence of at least up to a metre high, and also dig it under the ground, so when they tunnel underneath they still hit that fencing. Another way of stopping them, even if they do get into your garden, rather than fencing the whole of your garden, is just to put those net tunnels over your fruit crops and vegetable crop as they're growing up. So that keeps the rabbits away. Likewise, birds as well might occasionally eat young seedlings that are just growing out, or take your fruit if you've got raspberries and cherries and things. Then gardeners growing those know that birds can be a big problem. Using a net or a fruit cage is the only really easy way of doing that. I've not found scarecrows to work that well, but if you want to give it a go, you can try a scarecrow in your garden. Squirrels are becoming an increasingly bigger problem in city gardens and countryside gardens, digging up bulbs. stealing all the bird food as well. They're such agile creatures that they're very difficult to keep at bay, but putting nets over plant seedlings, and if you're putting bulbs in the garden, maybe just a wire mesh over where you've put the bulbs will stop the squirrels digging down, but that generally is quite a hard thing to avoid. And if they're eating your bird seed, there is a trick of just putting some chili powder into bird seed, because birds don't really notice it at all, but a squirrel's tongue will detect the chili and hopefully make a run for it rather than eating your bird seed. Cats, again, are a big problem in gardens, but if anybody's got any solutions to that, please let me know, because I've never managed to keep the cats out. Slugs and snails, apart from using other wildlife to try and keep those at bay, and the beer traps as well, there's a nematodes that you can get on the market, usually for mail order. Garden centres generally can't stock them because they need to be kept chilled. So if you order them online, you add it to water, put it in a watering can and sprinkle it over whatever crops you're trying to protect. Slugs will come along and digest this, or ingest this rather, and over time these little organisms, the nematodes, will grow out through the slugs. And it sounds quite cruel, but it's a natural way of controlling slugs, and it doesn't affect us at all, and it's quite effective. But you will have to probably look online to get hold of those. I mean, there's quite a few things that come into your garden that are quite nice to see with your hedgehogs and things, but on the whole, keeping on top of your insects and your pests that are coming into the garden is something you can do all year round, really. So.
Fantastic. Once more, thank you very much, Jodie.
Thank you.
Andrew Brown was on the show recently talking about the Bristol riots. So here in another interview, he's going to talk about the impact of the riot and a potted history of the various riots that occurred in previous times in this turbulent city.
And here we have Andrew Brown, who's studying the history of music in the 18th century, but today he's talking about the Bristol riots. Hi.
Thank you. Yes, that seems perhaps a strange combination, but I should say that I'm studying the history of music in what's often called the long 18th century by historians.
And which other riots were taking place in other cities in Britain?
There were riots during 1831 in quite a few regional centres. Nottingham and Derby are always cited. And there were some further riots after the Bristol riot, Leeds, I think, and other cities in the north. But Bristol was by far the biggest, and the loss of control was so complete. That is really what I think what worried the authorities so greatly, that, you know, a major regional city had been unable to deal with what was really initially apparently quite disorganised mob violence, and had seen quite substantial parts of the city burn.
And you said earlier that you were studying music in the 18th century, and what effect did the Bristol riots have on its music?
Well, it certainly affected the cultural life, and indirectly I think it affected the music. The street around the square where most of the violence took place, Queen Square, included King Street, where the theatre was, so obviously the theatre had to close for a while after the riots. I think the culture of the time does reflect, initially in the period leading up to the Great Reform Act, a long period of frustration, repression of popular demand for reform, and that is manifest in many things such as popular ballads, broadsides, which are ways of expressing, if you like, a popular sentiment. And I think also there's a strong element in Bristol, which after the riot really reacted against the whole issue of reform. And you find, oddly, that although in the year of reform, Bristol had two Whig MPs, therefore more likely to support reform, in the aftermath of the riot, Bristol became very reactionary and returned two Conservative members. And one of those was Vivian, who was notably a reactionary. So he set about building a bastion of the old order, if you like, mainly in Clifton, actually. And that's ultimately represented by the building of the Victoria Rooms, which is one of the largest monumental buildings in the southwest of England. That was at first intended as the Conservative Rooms, but it became, in fact, the main centre of concert giving in Bristol after it was finished some years later. So really, I think the riots are a sort of cultural fulcrum or pivot. If I might just also add, I find it quite strange today walking through the square that the famous statue of King William III has been restored in the centre, and he represents the old order, if you like, which the rioters were against, a very repressive capitalist order which was called liberal, but that's one of the ironies of the period. And yet there is nothing that I'm aware of in the square, although it's been restored with lottery funds, which really makes clear how important that riot was, how many people died, and how significant, you know, for the history of the politics of this country, the events of those two nights in October of 1831 were. I think that's a real omission, a glaring omission. And it's surprising that no one has built some sort of memorial or monument.
And so we need more information about this. And also, you were saying that the casualties, do we still believe that only 12 people died?
Well, no, I mean, I think obviously there are now studies which make very clear that the death toll must have been vastly greater than 12. But I have read even in quite recent reference books that that's the figure quoted. This goes on, obviously, right through the 19th century. You get famous Bristol historians like Latimer, who was a Whig and therefore believed that the liberal system of England was sort of beyond criticism, didn't want, obviously, to have to tell people that the loss of control in Bristol had been so serious that hundreds of people, mainly citizens, had lost their lives. And that tradition really rather carried on. But the attempt to cover up, obviously, was partly because the aldermen themselves were very worried that they would be accused of negligence in their duties. In the end, it was the military men who were the scapegoats. And I feel very, very sorry for poor Lieutenant Colonel Brereton, because he had to face a court-martial. He tried very hard to avoid violence, but eventually he was so distraught by the accusations made against him that he took his own life during the hearings.
Would you say that Bristol had a tumultuous past?
Well, there was a history of rioting in Bristol. It was already known to be a city where mob violence broke out from time to time, normally quite localised, and normally to do with a particular issue which didn't necessarily affect the whole country in the way that the pressure for reform affected the Reform Acts of 1832. The miners in Kingswood were famous for removing turnpike gates and destroying lock gates. There were food riots in years when bread was expensive, but the corporation realised that that could be avoided by hoping to subsidise the price of bread, making bread more easily affordable. There were riots against religious groups such as dissenters. There was a riot against the Jews in 1753, who were here in quite small numbers. But oddly, in 1780, the year when there were very substantial riots against Catholics in parts of Britain, Bristol didn't have a Gordon riot of its own, so it didn't quite fit the national pattern. But it was known to be a riotous place. Even in Matthew's guide of 1793, the first official guide to Bristol, he mentioned that the populace were apt to form mobs and assemblies quite frequently.
Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks there to Andrew Brown, who was talking about the Bristol riots.
They sang about in songs I heard. It took your kisses to reveal that I was wrong, and the love is real. Hold me close, hold me fast. You cast this is on your own.
can thrive. And though I close my eyes, I still have your rose. When you press it to your heart, I'm in a world apart, a world where roses bloom. And when you speak, angels sing from above. Everyday words seem to turn into love. Heart and soul to me, and life will always be love your own.
That, of course, was Edith Piaf, a street singer from Paris. Manet used such women as subjects for his paintings, the most famous being Victorine. A painter in her own right, she died of poverty and drink. So let's hear our next feature, which is all about Manet and the exhibition of his work shown at the Royal Academy in London.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sue Housego. What are we talking about, Manet?
You've been to see the exhibition in London, which has been highly successful. Could you just give us a background to Manet and his work?
Well, Manet is a fascinating character. Great feeling about Manet was this use of Paris. Well, it was really rearranged by Haussmann, so it took away all the medieval streets where the people lived, and you had this replacing with wide boulevards, which meant, of course, revolution was more difficult because you couldn't do barricades. But it brought in the upper and middle class, I suppose, bourgeoisie into Paris, which meant there was a sort of a new outburst of leisure in a funny sort of way. The flaneur, the walking about, being seen, being elegant in the air. But in the same time, although with a déjeuner you have his model, the nude with the dressed men, you all know this picture, which caused outrage because, of course, obviously there was no nude bathing. Many things were banned, and certainly the idea of a nude woman with clothed men was outrageous, simply outrageous.
So, could you just describe the painting for those people who don't know the painting? It's
four people. It's a very strange perspective. So you have on the left Victorine, who is his model, and she's looking straight out. And the unusual thing is that she's gazing at the viewer. So she looks out at you, confronts you, and is totally unaffected by her nudity. And men are clothed, and although it was a studio painting, they're wearing an outdoor hat, at least one man is. And then you've got all the significant things of the frog, which was the sign of the prostitute, and the bullfinch, I think it's a bullfinch, up on the branch. So it's full of symbolism for the idea, really. I think there were many hidden meanings, some of which we still won't know today. But if you go and look at just the painting and the vigour and the sort of depths of the blacks and these wonderful greens and this bathing woman in the background. And of course it comes from Giorgione, and then Picasso paints it. So you go through on and on with this idea of a painting that's carried through. And that's a wonderful thing to see too. Colours and energy.
What about Goya?
He was very keen on Goya. And there are colour, of course, and the black and the white, and also his painting of the balcony, and this dark, luxurious paint, and the feeling of emotion, so different from the classical world. This was a world that was full of emotion and colour and vigour, but nevertheless, the people are all displaced. They don't interact. You can look at their faces, and they're not engaged with each other. It's as if they're in their own private world. And I think Manet thought that was what had happened to the Parisian. That's, of course, not places like the Tuileries Garden, where he puts himself in the left-hand corner and his brothers are there and all the writers, Baudelaire, Zola, all, and painters, of course, Monet and people. So that's a big, friendly painting. Very beautiful again.
Can you tell us about his other model, Berthe Morisot?
Well, again, he met her, and she was a painter in her own right, and he thought her very beautiful. And he painted her series of paintings, one very dramatic when she's ill, some when she's very beautiful. She married his brother, so they were close as a family, and she was a painter herself. So you can see the affection. They're very glowing paintings. She has this beautiful, I don't know, very black. Again, she's got this look somehow of maybe the Goya paintings with black luxurious hair and the white skin. So I suppose, again, that was that sense of people staring out at the canvas, people absorbed in their own thoughts. I imagine it was something like that.
Would you say Manet was a graphic artist because of his great love of black and white and contrast in his paintings?
Well, not graphic, really, because you feel that's the classical painters that were engaged with line and not so much colour. And although he's not like Delacroix, in that Delacroix was just wild and beautiful colours, he did love Delacroix, and you can feel that the paint is the thing. He was more interested in the paint and the extremes of light and dark. And I think this sense always of people in reverie, thinking and absorbed in themselves. Line, I don't think, was of great importance to him. I think that was the classicist, Ingres, and the delicacy of the line was everything, and colour was unimportant. For Manet, the colour is important, and the shades and the terrific shadows, dark and light, and layers of black. He was called magnificent, and he was also hated, and there's a lovely quotation here, which is wonderful. It says that unlike the smooth textures of the day, these were the ones that were accepted by the salon, he was criticised, his work gouges the eyes in the same way as carnival music bloodies the ear. So you can feel the anger there. That was a critic writing at the time of looking at, I think that was particularly the Tuileries Gardens. But others said he could handle paint. So he was both revered, probably more by artists, but was a puzzle, I think, to the viewers, the everyday viewers. He was refused at the salon with I think, about 1,000 others.
Can you just tell us a bit about Manet's relationship with the salon?
He was determined to be exhibited. He felt that was everything. You worked towards the salon, that was where you were exhibited. And, of course, you couldn't sell unless you were in the salon. So it was a crucial part of his need to exhibit there. But also, I think he felt he wanted that acceptance.
So do you think Manet, by having the exhibition at the RA, has brought him to the forefront of the Impressionists? Because has he been a bit overshadowed by Monet, do you think, and the others?
Yes, because he always said he was not an Impressionist, although they were very close. Monet and he used to go and paint on boats in the river, and that was a very great interest of theirs. But I think the thing is, when you go into that exhibition, apart from the fact it's terrifically popular, which is always wonderful, you go and you think, well, you know, there'll be a normal amount of people, but it's full of people. And there is something so dramatic going down as you're walking through. You're struck most of all by the intensity of the paintings, I think. The fact that people look out at you, that they're still, and yet at the same time there's this real human dilemma. I suppose it's the human centre that perhaps is the most exciting, and the huge power of the blacks and whites, and that incredible paintwork, great big loose brush strokes, so different from the classical painters with their smooth, beautiful linear work. So you suddenly realise how he's a man on his own. He's neither from the past, nor is he going to be impressionist. If you look at his work, it's something else. It's something between the classical world and the romantic world, really. It's real, but very, very individual, strangely beautiful, but not beautiful in the way you would say impressionists are beautiful.
The painters of that period, they never cease to attract huge crowds. What is their appeal?
I suppose it's... If you're thinking of Monet, and Degas, all those, their colour, isn't it? It's their colour, the fact that it was fresh air, it was outside, it was full of life and vigour. And maybe we go because it's the holiday feel, it's the sense of movement and light and life, perhaps that's it. The Salon pictures were different, weren't they? The early Salon pictures, they were set up and studied and thought through. Whereas you can see that it moves into being glimpses of life, everyday life, sort of life you want to lead, really, I suppose. I suppose that's why people love it. I don't know, you just go and look at the paint, don't you? And you light up. Something about it feeds you. Most of us are living drab lives, or we're used to looking at screens, and what joy it is to go into a gallery, and then you're confronted by these wonderful hands-on, somebody has worked and worked at it, and you feel as if they're offering you something, something you can share, like a really good book. And I love that idea too with Zola, where he's sharing the idea of the painter and the writer and the interaction of the thinking and the deep concerns of life, really. I think perhaps that's what the man is. It's the deep concerns of life, not the superficial. Maybe that was it.
That was Sue Roberts, interviewed by Anthea Page.
We have with us Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello there. Okay, this is called Losing the Line. The Vatican's drenched in the stench of its sin, as it turns two blind eyes to its paid file ring. Our society cries out, oh, where is our spine, as the great institutions lose sight of the line. The poor just get poorer and know they can't win, so they blow their last chance on a lottery fling, and try to ignore the signs of decline as the great institutions lose sight of the line. The banks, the churches, the centres of power, build screens round their deeds to keep the truth in. And who is to blame? Is it your fault or mine that the great institutions lose sight of the line? A favour's a favour, a crime is a crime. We make our distinctions in spite of the slime. We'd like to know more, but we haven't the time. Could it be that we're also losing the line? Conspiracy theorists who chew late in the night on the roots of the cause of humanity's plight, though usually left, may sometimes be right in casting their light on the loss of the line. The timelines we've travelled are now ravelled up. There's a common consensus on what is corrupt, and when systems go down, it can be abrupt. And these are the reasons we're losing the line. I'm interested in history. This one I wrote after seeing a BBC documentary. It was about, the programme was called The Untold Story. And one of the things that came out from the programme mentioned that during the fall of Berlin, there was as many as 100,000 women were raped, mostly by soldiers of the Red Army. The whole society was kind of in a state of collapse. So it's thinking about how, well, there's a book I'm reading at the moment called The Reader, which kind of ties in with this as I'm thinking about it, and about how Germany has responded to the situation and how they've moved on from it, or the extent to which they have. So, you know, so there's lots of ongoing issues there. It's called Berlin 1945. They all knew that the end was upon them, and that this was the last stage of the game. They all knew that the world would condemn them, and their excuses would all sound lame. And the women all cried together, and the men all wept in alone. And the echoes are heard forever, for they know there's no way to atone. Intoxicated by pride and glory, they had forgotten about decency. They believed in Hitler's crazy story and how wondrous their future would be. The elixir was laced with hemlock, although they recognized this, far too late, but when finding themselves in a headlock, they realized that this was their fate. So the women all cried together, and the men all wept alone, and the echoes are heard forever, and they know there's no way to atone. Then the remnants of the ruined nation wondered how it had come to this, but being guilty by association, they recognized their nemesis. Then the women all cried in their grief, and the men all wept in their shame, and the women all wished for relief, while the men wondered who they could blame. Wars are tyrants, wars are teachers, so why weren't the lessons learnt? For they followed Nazi preachers when the history books were burnt. Within the hearts of the humbled, hubris turned into remorse as their dreams of empire crumbled, fading shadows of spent force. They had hated the world together, but now looked for love alone, and they knew they'd be tainted forever, and their hearts felt dead as stone. War makes way for reconstruction, and a chance to break the mould, so they accepted bold instruction and did all that they were told. Plans were made and plans were followed once the past was all laid bare. Using all the funds they borrowed, they worked hard and built with care. Now the women all smile together, and the men do all that they can. Yet the war still echoes forever for each woman and each man. It's historical, but it's still ongoing, really.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski. The producer, Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul.
And me, Kay Sangandaffy.
And it's goodbye from me, James Melia.
Until next week, goodbye.